I am James Butt in Washington, wishing you will have a terrific Tuesday.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Ukrainian troops expanded their territorial gains by pushing all the way back to the country's northeastern border in places. They also claimed to have captured a record number of Russian soldiers. The gains on Monday were part of the lightning advance that forced Moscow to make a hasty retreat. A spokesman for Ukrainian military intelligence says that Russian troops are surrendering en masse. A Ukrainian presidential advisor had said that there were so many POWs that the country was running out of space to accommodate them. And blue and yellow Ukrainian flags fluttered over nearly newly liberated towns across the wide swath of reclaimed land. The Ukrainian military said it had freed more than 20 settlements within a 24-hour period. Russia's war in Ukraine and the Holy See's strained relations with China are the backdrop to Pope Francis's visit to Kazakhstan. Francis was flying Tuesday to the Kazakh capital to meet with the president. He also is administering to a tiny Catholic community and participating in an interfaith confederate during his three-day visit. Another noteworthy aspect of his visit is the missed opportunity that Francis was supposed to have met with the head of the Russian Orthodox Church on the sidelines of that conference. But the Patriarch Kirill, who was justified in the war in Ukraine, canceled, or saying that he's justified the war in Ukraine, canceled that very same trip just last month. Carlos Alcaraz is the U.S. Open champion and the number one ranked player in the men's tennis at age 19. And he says he's exhausted, telling the Associated Press on Monday that he is not quite sure how he managed to play. This is VOA News. A modern United States Nations agency says that 50 million people have lived as modern slaves just last year. More from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
Worldwide were living in modern slavery at the end of last year. That marked a 25% increase over the previous report 5 years ago. The International Labor Organization, the UN's International Organization for Migration, and the Walk Free Foundation reported Monday 28 million people were living in forced labor and 22 million were in forced marriages at the end of 2021. Two-thirds of all forced marriages were found in the Asia-Pacific region, the world's most populous region, but the highest number per capita was in Arab countries. I'm Mike Gracia.
The Justice Department in the U.S. says it is willing to accept one of Donald Trump's picks for an independent arbiter to review documents seized during an FBI search of the former president's Florida home just last month. The accommodation could help accelerate the selection process and shorten any delays caused by the appointment of the so-called special master. The judge in the case, granting a request from the Trump team, said last week that she would appoint a neutral arbiter to go through the records and weed out any that may be covered by executive privilege or attorney-client privilege. An Emirati court has ruled that a British man suspected of masterminding the $1.7 billion tax scheme cannot be extradited to Denmark to face charges. The decision in the high-profile case grants the hedge fund manager or trader Sanjay Shah a victory against Danish authorities who sought him for his role in one of the country's largest ever fraud cases. Monday's court ruling, delivered after a closed-door hearing without explanations, can be appealed by the prosecutors. The elaborate scheme, which ran for 3 years beginning in 2012, allegedly involved foreign businesses pretending to own shares in Danish companies and claiming tax refunds for which they were not eligible. Recapping our top story, Ukrainian troops expanded their territorial gains by pushing all the way back to the country's northeastern border in places. They also claimed to have captured a record number of Russian soldiers. The gains on Monday were part of the lightning advance that forced Moscow to make a hasty retreat. More at VOAnews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, September 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine reclaims more territories, pushes Russian forces back to the northeastern border.
Senior military and defense officials speaking to reporters on Monday talked about how this is indeed an initial victory for Ukraine and that they are clearly making progress in the south and the east.
Ethiopia's Tigrayan forces call for ceasefire after 3 weeks of renewed fighting.
In a statement to mark the beginning of the Ethiopian New Year, the Tigray region's leadership called for a comprehensive negotiated ceasefire and said they had established a negotiating team that is ready to be deployed about the delay.
And a UN expert reports, quote, staggering repression, unquote, of women and girls under Taliban rule. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukrainian troops have reclaimed more territory from Russia and pushed all the way back to the northeastern border in some places. The gains are part of a lightning advance that forced Moscow to make a hasty retreat from occupied lands. As blue and yellow Ukrainian flags fluttered over newly liberated towns, the Ukrainian military said its troops had freed more than 20 settlements in 24 hours. After months of little movement on the battlefield, the momentum has shifted Ukrainian morale and provoked rare public criticism of President Vladimir Putin's war. U.S. defense officials are also monitoring the fast-shifting battle landscape. For more, I spoke with VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Seldon.
Senior military and defense officials speaking to reporters on Monday talked about how this is indeed an initial victory for Ukraine and that they are clearly making progress in the south and the east, especially around Kharkiv, where they said that Russian forces have clearly ceded ground to Ukraine. They say that there are still reasons to be concerned, though. Russia still has a formidable force. Clearly, there are weaknesses with the Russian force along those front lines, both around Kharkiv and even in Kherson in the south, but that it's going to be a tough fight for the Ukrainians going forward. And they expect that that will continue both around Kharkiv and elsewhere. Although they also say that the U.S. approach trying to back Ukraine and give the Ukrainian military the support it needs has been successful to date.
Based on the successes so far of the Ukrainian forces, is the Pentagon reassessing the situation? Is there an end game here?
Senior defense military officials and senior administration officials have said repeatedly, and they've said it again recently, that they support Ukraine's territorial integrity, Ukraine's sovereignty, and that's come up even in their question about what would the U.S. do should Ukrainian forces continue to make progress and perhaps even decide to push into Crimea and perhaps try to retake Crimea from Russia. U.S. officials have also spoken repeatedly about looking at not just the short term, this current conflict, the immediate war between Ukraine and invading Russian forces, but also about the medium term and the long-term support that the Ukrainian military would need. In that context, there have been questions about whether or not the U.S. would supply fighter jets or other advanced military equipment. And what U.S. officials have said consistently is that something that they are talking about in the medium to long term. What type of support, what type of weaponry will the Ukrainian military need as a NATO ally going forward? And a lot of times the talk has been more about than just fighter jets or other specific requests by the Ukrainian military, but looking about what type of aid would be given and the fact that the U.S. and its Western allies see a need to move Ukraine from the Soviet era, Soviet style equipment that its military has been using to equipment that is compatible with NATO forces, since Ukraine is an ally of NATO.
That's VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Seldon speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Britain's defense ministry said Monday that Russia has likely ordered the withdrawal of its troops from the entirety of occupied Kharkiv Oblast west of the Oskil River. The defense ministry adds that Ukraine has recaptured territory at least twice the size of Greater London. For more on Ukraine's military counteroffensive, Anna Chernikova joins Flashpoint Ukraine's host Steve Miller.
For the moment, we know that 99% of the Kharkiv region has been liberated by Ukrainian forces. This includes such crucial and key cities as Balaklia, Izum, and Kupiansk. Izum was one of the main bases of the Russian forces, and this is a strategic place in terms of its location because it's located at the end of the Kharkiv region, beginning of the Donetsk region. So Ukrainian forces managed to take almost the whole territory of Kharkiv region under control. We know that for the moment, in general, what was confirmed by the general staff of Ukraine, that we're talking about around 3,000 square kilometers of the territories. And we know that counteroffensive is going on. And for the moment, we don't have confirmation of the settlements or of the amount of settlements liberated. But we know that there are more in the Kherson region. And also we know that Ukrainian forces also continue their counteroffensive actions in the Luhansk region and Donetsk region. Also, General Staff has confirmed, and also the military heads of the Kharkiv region have confirmed that Ukrainian forces have reached the border with Russian Federation in the Kharkiv region, not in all of the border points, but in most of them.
Anna, you mentioned that Ukrainian forces have re-entered Izum. Can you kind of share and paint a picture of how important that is?
Well, the city of Izum is the city of 45,000 citizens, and the city was under occupation for 6 months. This is extremely important point if we look at the front line and if we look at the potential counteroffensive and advance of the Ukrainian forces to Donetsk region. And also for the Russian forces, this is an important city to support their actions in the Donetsk region as well. And as Institute for the Study of War mentioned in their latest report, the loss of Izum for Russian forces would mean a huge problem in terms of their advance in the Donetsk region.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine host Steve Miller from Kyiv. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Monday that Russia will achieve the goals of its, quote, special military operation, unquote, in Ukraine. It was the first reaction from the Kremlin to a lightning Ukrainian counteroffensive last week, in which Kyiv says it recaptured more than 3,000 square kilometers of territory in just a space of a few days. The body of late British Queen Elizabeth II has been taken from Balmoral Castle in Scotland, where she passed away Thursday, to Edinburgh. Over the coming days, members of the public will have the opportunity to visit the coffin and pay their respects to Elizabeth, who held the British throne for 7 decades. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Leaving Balmoral, the beginning of Elizabeth's final journey to lay in peace. The convoy tracked slowly through the majestic Scottish landscape, where she spent her final peaceful weeks of life. In years past, the Queen was seen frequently in these remote Scottish villages, a royal neighbour who loved this region and who was well loved in return. Now residents gathered on the roadside to glimpse her for the last time and say goodbye. The shock is still raw. The silence was gently broken by ripples of applause. Stephanie Cook is a resident of Ballater, close to Balmoral.
We've known for all our lives, so it's been the one constant thing in the whole of our lives. The Queen.
After a 6-hour journey, the convoy crossed the Firth estuary and arrived in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. Along the Royal Mile, thousands waited to see the cortege, among them Fiona Moffat from Glasgow.
A very historic moment. Quite speechless, actually. She was a lovely lady. Great mother, grandmother, and she did well. Very proud of her.
Elaine Robertson travelled from Ayr on Scotland's west coast.
I think it's just important to be here, just important to say goodbye. She's been on the throne for a long time. So, yeah, means a lot.
The coffin will lie in Edinburgh's St Giles Cathedral, where the public will be invited to pay their respects. It will then be taken by plane to London Tuesday, first to Buckingham Palace, and then in a public procession led by Elizabeth's son, King Charles III, to the 11th century Westminster Hall, where the late Queen will lie in state. The hall will be open 23 hours a day for visitors and guarded by soldiers from the royal household. Tens of thousands of people are expected to travel to Westminster to pay their respects. Robert Lacey is a royal historian and author.
She has been an exemplary head of state in terms of her devotion to her people and to her job. I think the other thing to take away, which is inevitable in all these crowds and expression of emotion, is the enduring command that the British monarchy holds over the emotions of people in Britain.
The funeral is scheduled for Monday, September 19th at Westminster Abbey. The coffin will then be taken to Windsor for the committal service, where the Queen's husband, Prince Philip, was laid to rest. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thank you, Henry. Ethiopia's Tigrayan forces called for an immediate ceasefire Sunday and said they will join an African Union-led peace process after 3 weeks of renewed fighting ended a fragile truce. Fred Hatcher reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Tigrayan forces from Ethiopia's northern region have said they are prepared to participate in an immediate cessation of hostilities, followed by peace talks mediated by the African Union. In a statement to mark the beginning of the Ethiopian New Year, the Tigray region's leadership called for a comprehensive negotiated ceasefire and said they had established a negotiating team that is ready to be deployed without delay. The government of Tigray is prepared to participate in a robust peace process under the auspices of the African Union, the statement said. The statement came as heavy fighting was reported along Tigray's northern, eastern and southern borders. The latest round of hostilities erupted on the 24th of August, bringing an end to a ceasefire agreed by the parties in late March. Each side blamed the other for starting the fighting. Thousands have been killed and millions displaced since the conflict broke out in November 2020. The Tigray forces have previously rejected the African Union as a mediator, claiming its peace envoy, former Nigeria President Olusegun Obasanjo, is too sympathetic to Ethiopia's federal government, and expressing a preference for talks in Nairobi overseen by Kenya and the US. Their call for a ceasefire was welcomed by the AU, the European Union and the United Nations. On Thursday, the UN said the fighting has halted much-needed aid deliveries to Tigray and war-affected parts of the neighbouring region of Amhara. The AU chairperson described the ceasefire call as a unique opportunity towards the restoration of peace in the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, while the EU Foreign Affairs head, Josep Borrell, said the EU was ready to support talks. Ethiopia's federal government has not yet responded to the statement from the Tigray region's leadership, but it has previously said it is ready to participate in AU-led talks anytime, anywhere, while also questioning the Tigray forces' commitment to resolving the conflict through dialogue. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
In other news, a UN expert said on Monday that human rights had deteriorated under the Taliban, describing, quote, a staggering repression, unquote, of women and girls and a descent towards authoritarianism, while Afghan women urged the global body to act. Richard Burnett, the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Afghanistan, called for radical changes in the country. Most girls' secondary schools in Afghanistan have been closed since the Taliban took over in August 2021, after the group made a sudden U-turn on promises to open them in March. Assistant Secretary General of Human Rights Elise Brands Keris said that some 850,000 girls had so far dropped out of school, placing them at risk of child marriage and sexual economic exploitation. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. A report presented at the opening of the 51st session of the UN Human Rights Council paints an alarming picture of growing abuse and violence in all regions of the world, with few rays of hope for a peaceful resolution. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Acting High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada Al-Nashif highlighted the growing desperation of millions of people trapped in a never-ending cycle of human rights violations, violence and political instability in dozens of countries around the world. She addressed the worsening situation in numerous countries in Africa, including Burkina Faso, Burundi, the Central African Republic, and Mali. She offered a rare glimmer of hope regarding the nearly two-year-old conflict in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province.
Following the recent resumption of hostilities in northern Ethiopia, I am encouraged encouraged by the announcement yesterday by authorities in Tigray of their readiness to abide by an immediate cessation of hostilities and to participate in a robust peace process under the auspices of the African Union. I urge the parties to take immediate steps to end the violence once and for all, and to opt for constructive and genuine dialogue.
She dwelled at length on the unbearable levels of violence and human rights abuses by heavily armed gangs in Haiti. She called on the international community to help contain the scourge of violence in that country. However, she made only passing reference to China's incarceration of more than a million Uyghur and other Muslim minorities in so-called vocational centers. This is despite growing demands by human rights activists for a special debate on this issue at the Council.
On 31 August, my office published its assessment of human rights concerns in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of China with recommendations to the government and other stakeholders.
Acting High Commissioner Al-Nashif was more robust in her criticism of Russia's actions aimed at quelling domestic opposition to its war in Ukraine.
In the Russian Federation, the intimidation, restrictive measures and sanctions against people voicing opposition to the war in Ukraine undermine the exercise of constitutionally guaranteed fundamental freedoms. Pressure against journalists, blocking of internet resources, and other forms of censorship are incompatible with media pluralism and violate the right to access of information.
Al-Nashif said the war in Ukraine continues and the suffering of the civilian population continues. She noted the serious socioeconomic consequences of the war also persist. This, she said, has resulted in severe fuel shortages and threats to food security in some of the world's poorest countries. She added the devastation caused by the war in Ukraine will be discussed later in the session. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
50 million people were living in modern slavery last year, according to global estimates just released by the International Labour Organization, the group Walk Free, and International Organization for Migration. Terry Fitzpatrick is the director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Human Trafficking in the U.S., a group that works with all three groups to end modern slavery. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the figures means forced labor and forced marriage have increased significantly over the past 5 years.
The thing that's important to know in the report is it's everywhere. It's illegal everywhere, but it's happening everywhere, and that's important to know. From reading the report, you can see that the highest total number of people in modern forms of forced labor are in the Asia-Pacific region, but the highest prevalence or percentage of the population in countries where you find yourself having more people in modern forms of slavery are in the Arab state and through the Middle East. So it's a different picture in different parts of the world.
Is that mostly due to cultures and tradition?
I think a lot of it's also due to migration. Now, the number that the report puts on it is about 15% of people who are in forced labor situations today are outside their home country. And so that does mean 85% of forced labor is happening right at home within a country, even within people's own home villages. But I think what you find in a lot of the Middle East countries is people migrate for construction jobs, for service jobs at hotels, to work as domestic workers. And so that changes the dynamic of who is in the country and who might be in situations of forced labor.
Like you just pointed out, the report says most cases of forced labor, 86%, are found in the private sector. How does that happen?
I think one of the most important things to understand here is that this report further highlights the need to light a fire under movement and governments around the world to get going and fund the efforts that are necessary to fight this problem. And it helps dispel some myths. The myth that modern slavery or human trafficking is about brothels and it's about forced commercial sexual exploitation. It is, but it's mostly about people working in forced labor in manufacturing, or in mines, or in domestic workers, or construction, or in agriculture. And that's where the largest percentage of the problem is. 17 million people in private businesses or by private crew leaders or organizations exploiting people in forms of modern slavery or forced labor, and about 4 million more people forced by governments in prison factories or prison camps or relocation or education centers, as some countries euphemistically call them, to work without remuneration and unable to escape.
That's Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Human Trafficking in the U.S., speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam.
Every year, world leaders gather in New York for the annual United Nations General Assembly. Count on VOA to be there, delivering news you can trust on radio, TV, and the web.
Le discours présidentiel, aux entretiens en tête-à-tête avec des responsables gouvernementaux de haut niveau, nous vous tiendrons informés des développements importants touchant le continent.
Líderes africanos vão abordar tópicos como alterações climáticas, o estado da economia, saúde, iniciativas juvenis e muito mais.
Usikose kufuatilia habari na vipindi maalum katika lugha 16 tofauti kuhusu kongamano la viongozi moja kwa moja kutoka makao makuu ya Umoja wa Mataifa mjini New York na Washington DC. Tutakuarifu kila tukio.
A free press is essential. VOA Africa.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been International Edition and the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned by the decision by the Hanoi People's High Court to uphold the 9-year prison sentence of renowned Vietnamese author and journalist Pham Doi Trang. As State Department spokesperson Ned Price noted in a statement expressing concerns over the decision, Trang is recognized internationally for her work to advance human rights and good governance in Vietnam and was a 2022 winner of the Secretary of State's International Women of Courage Award. Trang was arrested in October 2020 and sentenced in December 2021 to 9 years in prison under Article 117 of Vietnam's Criminal Code, which criminalizes making, storing, distributing, or disseminating information, documents, and items against the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. International human rights organizations have called Article 117 a tool to silence individuals who are critical of the government, whether they are journalists, writers, or citizens exercising their fundamental right to free expression. The UN Working Group of Arbitrary Detention found Trang's detention to be arbitrary and in contravention of Vietnam's international human rights commitments and obligations. The government held Trang in pretrial custody for a year without allowing her access to a lawyer. In the nearly 2 years she has been detained, Trang's health has reportedly suffered. Spokesperson Price said the United States urges Vietnam to ensure adequate medical care and to allow access to Trang to assess her medical condition. In its most recent report on human rights conditions in Vietnam, the State Department cited NGOs that estimated as of August 2021, authorities held between 130 and 288 persons for political reasons. The State Department wrote, from January 1st to November 9th, authorities detained 29 and convicted 27 persons who were exercising internationally recognized human rights, such as freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association. Spokesperson Price said, Trang's continued detention is the latest instance in an alarming pattern of arrests and sentencing of individuals in Vietnam for peacefully expressing their opinions. We call on the Vietnamese government to release Trang and to allow all individuals in Vietnam to exercise their right to freedom of expression without fear of retaliation, consistent with the human rights provisions in Vietnam's constitution and Vietnam's international obligations and commitments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.